Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Very welcome along to the latest episode of the Group Chat Podcast. I am news correspondent Sarah King, joined in studio by my fellow news correspondent Richard Chambers.
How's it going?
I always say the hello is a bit awkward, isn't it? It's a bit cringe.
We said hello multiple times, we didn't just appear in the studio.
I think the
goodbyes. Speaking to each other for quite a while.
We have, so it's a bit much. And political correspondent Gavin Riley.
Hello,
Gavin.
How are you, Sarah?
Do you know when we were saying goodbye last week, there was such a delay that when I said goodbye, it was like this really weak sort of like, bye.
It was basically Saturday morning by the time
it was quite poor. How are you both keeping? Good?
Not too bad. How are you?
Yeah, how's
look at our new setting now on a Wednesday night.
Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Oh. Welcome to Wednesday night.
There we go.
Big leagues.
Champions League stuff is
there
what it
go.
Is.
Yeah. Top four finish for the lads.
We're delighted if you're joining us on Wednesday night or if you're joining us on Thursday morning for the podcast. We hope you enjoy the next hour of conversation about what's been happening in the world, what's been happening in the news. We're going to start with the eviction ban. Both of you have been working on this this week. The government approving a one-off ban on evictions ahead of the exceptional winter period. Under the plans, notice of termination can be issued to tenants, but the property does not have to be vacated until the ban is phased out next year. Going to start with you, Gav. What exactly does this actually mean for people?
What it means in practice is that as long as you have been fulfilling all the obligations of a tenant, in other words, paying your rent, making sure the place is kept up and not effectively trashing the place, you are entitled to stay where you are at the very least until the 1st of April. And this seems to apply as long as you are meeting your obligations in pretty much every context. So, and we've been taking some questions, but one of the big questions that we got in Instagram was from a category of people who were like, well, can I move back into my own house? If I left my own house for a fixed period and my tenants knew that I was going to come back at a certain time, can I still take the house back? And it would seem from what the government is telling me, you can't. Like, such is the level of protection that you're now going to have where X number of people, I think 2,273 is the oddly precise projection that the government has put forward for the number of tenancies that now won't be terminated under this. But in effect, the long and the short of it is that as long as you are doing everything a tenant is supposed to do, you're allowed to stay where you are at least until the 1st of April and potentially until the middle of June, depending on whatever time you might be served with your notice or how long you've already been living there.
Is this a welcome relief, do you reckon?
It is, yeah. From the people I've been talking to who have really been angling and pushing for this for a long time. So groups like the Simon Community, like Focus Ireland, like the Peter McVerry Trust, they've all been saying that there really does need to be an evictions ban of some form for a long, long time now. And they actually can't understand why there's been so much foot dragging about it. I mean, obviously the government said that it would be unconstitutional initially, more on that a little bit later on. But when there has been, as they have noticed, Threshold in particular, which, you know, it does a great job at crunching the numbers on housing and homelessness, they have seen over the course of this year a big, big spike in the number of notices to quit which have been served to end tenancies in comparison, not just with the COVID years, but with 2019 as well. Effectively almost a doubling on average per month of that. So when you're seeing all that happen and when you're seeing it come towards a winter where there is a big shortage of accommodation, obviously the homeless crisis, I think it lands a lot more in the public imagination over winter because of the fears of what happens when people are sleeping rough over that period. When you have all these things, plus the landlords who say they're going to be leaving, and the biggest reason for notices to quit these days is because landlords are selling up, that they are selling the property, so your tenancy's over, out you go. So when you have all these things coming together, they say it was inevitable that something like this actually needed to happen. So one voice I just want to bring to you is Wayne Stanley of the Simon Communities of Ireland. He basically says that this was so essential because there is no emergency accommodation left in the country. People would have found themselves sleeping in all sorts of bad situations.
It's particularly around families, and I suppose the particular focus is children in those families. We saw, even when we had the moratorium on evictions during COVID, we saw single homelessness continue to increase.
Yeah, so what Wayne's saying there, really eloquently about, you know, people potentially having to sleep in cars, sleep in Garda stations, sleep in tents, which we're already seeing in various situations again around the country.
Yeah, and we've seen it before, haven't we? A couple of years ago.
Very high profile.
Very high profile cases, yeah.
Yeah, so this is something he says would have become a lot, lot worse if this wasn't in place. So broad welcome from that. I think even politically there has been as well sort of a let's get this in as quickly as possible. It's kind of been the overwhelming political consensus.
If there is
agreement,
it's almost what are we going to do to make sure that the situation isn't this bad in April? Are we going to provide more emergency accommodation, or what are you going to do to get the finger out to try and resolve this so that by the time this is lifted, that the crisis has ended? You mentioned the lack of emergency accommodation. It's actually worth kind of reflecting on this, because a lot of the questions that we've also had in that we've all been getting on Instagram are, how is this allowed, given that everyone was saying up until now that it wasn't allowed? You know, and you're going to talk in a moment, Richard, about the constitutional challenges that there might be on the way. The official reason that the government is giving is that they now believe this is legally sound or safe or permissible, because by their own admission, they are running out of emergency accommodation. So three months or 6 or 9 or 12 or 18 months ago, they would say, well, yeah, there might be loads of people who can't afford their rent and have nowhere else to go, but the state is capable of at least providing a hotel room or refuge somewhere for those people to have a roof over their heads at night. And the reason why they now think it's tenable to intervene in the market is because they, by their own admission, they are running out of beds because of the volume of people that are already homeless and living in emergency accommodation, the number of beds that have been given over to Ukrainian refugees, the number of other beds that are being claimed by people seeking asylum in the country through international protection. When you throw all of those together, we're running out of beds in the country. And the state only believes this is tenable now because it's incapable of providing a backup option, which is pretty grim if you think about it.
It's pretty appalling, isn't it, when you think about it?
But it is also the terrible silver lining to that awful cloud is that that's why the government now believes that it has the legal cover to go ahead with this.
Yeah. And as well, when you couple the emergency accommodation situation with the fact that there's just no private rental accommodation in the country as well, and even less for people who are depending on payments and supports like HAP, for example, effectively, forget about it. If you're reliant on HAP, there's nothing there for you in most of the country. The landlords, surprise, surprise, are the only people who are quite aggrieved by this. So they were all in. I was actually at the I was outside the meeting on the day before it was announced. They all went in for a meeting with Dara O'Brien, the housing minister. So you had your sort of property owners, landlords and letting agents, their representative groups, and you had representatives for the homeless and the RTB, the Residential Tenancies Board as well. So they're all in a meeting to hammer it out and here's what exactly is coming. What do you need for us to just give this the go ahead? And effectively what landlords are saying is, we need more supports, but we're all going to be selling up anyway. And it's kind of just a situation where some of the groups representing landlords, like the IPOA, the Irish Property Owners Association, their view on it was that it just won't help and it won't work, which is not really what anybody else is saying in terms of groups representing the homeless, and even by the government's own admission in terms of the number you quoted, Gav.
Yeah.
So the IPOA, not happy with it. And they were so unhappy with it that they actually floated for a time on Tuesday morning the idea of them actually taking a constitutional challenge of this. And they haven't written it off now.
They said it almost firstly as if it was absolutely going to happen, and then it seemed like they tried to sort of walk it back or say that they might do it over the course of the day.
Yeah, they did. Because they initially said, I think it was on News Talk Breakfast on the radio this on Tuesday morning, they said, yep, no, we're going to challenge this when it comes in. Then I chatted to them and they were like, well, we'll wait and see what happens. And then a little bit later on, once the announcement was actually made, they had a statement out saying, we're not going to comment on this, but it's unfair and it's unjust and it's, it penalises landlords, which sounds like a comment to me. But they didn't mention the fact that there would be a constitutional challenge. So I think there's been a bit of a walk back on that, just to try and kind of cool the situation down a little bit. But they did speak to us on Virgin Media News yesterday about how they view the situation. Here's a little bit of what they had to say.
We're not surprised because all the parties have been calling for it, particularly Sinn Féin. And really, you know, this is landlords being hijacked again, being blamed for the housing crisis. It's all got to do with the failure of successive governments to provide housing over the last few years, and over reliance on the private rental system to provide homes for people. So I suppose we're not surprised. We don't support it. We don't think it's going to achieve anything.
So, Gavin, what does it mean for people who have already gotten a notice now at the moment telling them that they have to be out of their house? Maybe they got the notice in the last couple of weeks. Yeah. Are those people protected?
As long as they were not supposed to be leaving the property in the next, what date is it? We're recording this in the 19th. As long as they're not supposed to leave in the next 12 days, they should be protected until the 1st of April. So the general principle behind this is that anyone who has already received a notice to quit or a termination notice, that basically this presses pause on the clock. So even if you only had a couple of days left by the 1st of November and you were looking to find somewhere else, the idea is that this basically presses pause. It's almost like one of those like 90s childhood sitcoms where somebody has like a stopwatch and they stop it and the entire world freezes. Mm. That kind of a burner's watch approach. And so that's basically it then.
That is the most Gav analogy I've ever heard in my life.
I was trying to think of the name of the program he's referencing.
Gav, and then doing Gav things. There you go. So that's basically what it is, that the clock stops immediately and you are protected until the end of March. Now, you mentioned, by the way, letting agents are how few properties there are in the rental market already. It's going to be even fewer. One of the questions that I got in was, what is it? Do you have any jobs going? Because I'm a rental agent, and between a lot of the other things that were going on in the rental market, and now this effectively shutting down any new properties because a lot of places that might have been vacant
to do, is it?
Aren't going to be vacant. That they're like, it's going to be very quiet for us for the next 5 or 6 months, which is, I'm not sure how legitimate it is, because I don't know to what extent more properties might come into the market, because you would think there probably wouldn't be that many people that are getting kicked out of their flat in order to make space for another tenant.
Can I just read you a tweet before you go on there from our friend and colleague Kira Phelan, who works for the Irish Examiner's tweet today. A 4-bedroom house has gone up for rent close to me, $8,700 a month. What young professional or student could afford to pay $2,175 a month for a room, or even, I guess, a family to rent that entire
house? I'd say that's, that sounds to me like a family situation. That there are, I think there's something, somebody I know who's in the letting business says that there's a big market for sort of higher priced family, full furnished sort of family homes
like
for people
who are key stuff.
And they're often short terms. I don't know what the exact situation is
but I still think that is astonishing.
That is wild.
Kind of mad,
wild.
What do you think about that, Gav? I mean, the points that you're on your question there about letting agents not having a lot to do. Like, I mean, you have to balance everything about this. Like, obviously, there are property rights and stuff like that. Mm. It's like, literally, Zara, like, I mean, it's an emergency situation and we're trying to prevent people from sleeping on the streets.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, society is better served by prioritising the property rights of landlords for this time, even though they're still going to be getting the rent and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, look, there are some people who are landlords who are small landlords and who obviously ended up in it because they had their own financial problems, and you have to empathise with those people, definitely, you know. But at the same time, like, you know, having met and interviewed so many families, you know, all of us have, that have been like given very short notice to quit. People who have children who've had, you know, places in schools and communities who they just absolutely cannot find a replacement property in that neighbourhood, uprooting their families. You know, we talk all the time about the unseen homeless, people who are back living at home with their parents, like, you know, whole generations of families living under one roof. Like, these are things that perhaps we don't even actually see that are very prevalent right now. And it's kind of that a bit, that sort of narrative around unable to launch, like unable to get a start, unable to get up and running, that people kind of find themselves in a situation where they've saved for the deposit, they've gotten the mortgage, and we'll get onto that in a second, the changes to the central bank lending rules, which will be significant for people, but will inevitably drive up prices of houses, even if it's just short term.
One group which is particularly affected by that, and actually was chatting to them last week, and there's a good few of them who are group chat listeners as well, who are speaking to us, were students. Students had a protest, obviously, last Thursday around accommodation and general cost of living crisis. A lot of them, just because of the lack of the availability of rental properties and rooms in Dublin and Galway and Limerick and Cork and everywhere around the country, Waterford, Kilkenny as well, basically long commutes. So a couple of different things here in what you're about to hear here. Stuff about the cost of living and not effectively being able to pay for heating when you're in your rented accommodation when you're up in college, you're traveling halfway across the country to get a room, you can't afford to heat it. And then the problem, which is trying to go through a whole degree or a post-leaving cert certificate when you have to commute every day for multiple hours.
I'm sitting in my apartment. Literally, we can't turn on the heating because it's too expensive.
Like this Tuesday, I was in work, and I was in work till 2 a.m. because I have to work. I have to be able to earn money. And then I have to go home. It's then 3 a.m. and then I have a 9 a.m. 3-hour class the next morning. And that does affect my education.
My commute is 2 hours each way every single day, like, and I'm shattered when I get home. It's draining me mentally and physically, like, I just can't keep doing it, like.
Well, I'm also forced to sometimes have to leave my classes early because there's also not enough time for me to get back down to the station to get home. So I'm forced to decide whether to leave class, stay, or try and find a way back home myself, and it's just not.
So to hear all of those views, Gavin, this is not something that, I mean, it's a very prevalent problem right now, but when you were a student back in 2007, given where your age now.
When I was a lad.
Yeah.
But like, all jokes aside, that was something that you had been protesting about during your student politics days.
One of the things that's really depressing about all of this is that I was the accommodation officer for UCD Students Union in 2007 and 2008.
Which was, and what was it like then? Was it
grim?
Now, it was grim then.
Now, I genuinely thought at the time that I'd find it hard to see any grimmer.
And because that was the tail end, remember, of the Celtic Tiger. Well, it was just coming to the roar was stopping.
Yeah, this is exactly it. So that basically housing had become so dear that a lot of people who had been otherwise staying in what had been earmarked as student accommodation or student digs or student flats were staying where they were because they couldn't afford anywhere else. And therefore, new students coming to the likes of UCD had nowhere else to move. And it's actually 15 years ago last month that I and other members of the student movement in Ireland slept outside Leinster House for a night. I pass by it now every day on my way into work, which is kind of bizarre.
Did young Gav know what was out in front of
looking for a student accommodation task force, because we were making the case then that we were already at a point where students just trying to go about the basics of going to a degree had nowhere to live or nowhere affordable to live. And we were promised at the time that there was going to be a student accommodation task force and that no colleges were ever going to rapidly expand without giving some thought to where all these people were going to live or expanding the college's own stock of on-campus or off-campus accommodation. And here we are now, 15 years later, and the problem is infinitely far worse. What was unfortunate about the timing of our protest in 2007 was that because the entire property market then collapsed 12 months later, all of the good intentions of the government to go and tackle the problem all dissolved away because there were far bigger issues at stake. So there was never any outcome to that student accommodation task force. But it's maybe a little story about how all these things keep getting raised in one generation and then the urgency goes away and no one ever does anything about it until suddenly we all get caught in a vice a generation down the line.
But I think the difference, Richard, right, is that, and I kind of remember because I was in college at the same time, we all remember, like, yes, there might have been an accommodation shortage, but that pinch in terms of paying your bills and your heating and things was a bit different, I think. I don't know, was it the same? I think what we're seeing now is almost a step further than that. This is not just, totally, as you say, yeah, about accommodation. Like, I don't know, maybe I just didn't see it, but I don't know if I remembered people not being able to maybe put the heating on in college back then, whereas I do think that's the change we're seeing now. So it means we're sort of going backwards in a lot of ways as a country.
Well, it is, and it's the combination of different things. Like you mentioned the heat and the cost of bills, which we're all obviously seeing. Then you're seeing the cost of even, you know, petrol for students who drive, public transport.
That's enormous. If you're commuting,
if you can't afford the accommodation, it's nearly dearer for you.
I'm just going to say, I would say fuel costs would be the same price as probably a room every week.
But it also goes to show, like, the stuff that falls through the cracks over the years, like investment in public transport and good routes, has an impact. Because if you are forced to rely on your own private car, driving up from, say, Carlow or Laois to Dublin every single day for college, well, like, the cost to you is astronomical. It increases the wait time for everybody else who's driving in on the same route. And effectively, it's a problem which is just pushed further and further down the line. And, you know, because the political issue of the day moves on so quickly, that the big structural problems are often left untouched for a long, long time.
But it's even if you say, use Carlow as an example there, Gav, right? You know, you obviously went to UCD. If you're coming up from Carlow to go to UCD every day, right? You get the train maybe from Carlow to Houston or whatever. Like, even to get from Houston across to UCD, like, is a real, that's a journey.
Sure,
like,
there's people
that's probably more of a journey than going from Carlow to Dublin.
I remember being friends with people in UCD who only lived in places like just outside Talla, like Firhouse, and had to get the bus into town to get the bus back out of town. I know, Richard, like, when I met you in UCD, you were getting two buses to get into town and out, but that's because you lived on the opposite side of the city. People who lived, like, within 15 minutes drive.
Richard, like, remembers those times, so, like, he just
the hates,
he's like, he literally just
spent an awful
it's almost like he finds it quite triggering.
Richard spent an awful lot of his life on those buses.
Far more time on,
like,
buses and trains.
Yeah, in 15 minutes drive of UCD and still have to get a bus into town and spend an hour on that bus to turn around and get another bus back out almost exactly the same direction, which is just a sign of how underinvested it all was.
More to come on the group chat. We'll talk to you after the break.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Well, the British Prime Minister is still battling to retain her position. I feel like we're repeating ourselves every week on this.
Yeah, doesn't matter who the Prime
she
Minister is.
She ever not battling to retain her position, unfortunately. Shouts of resign could be heard as she spoke today in the House of Parliament. It's been a difficult time for our colleagues across the water. We are joined now by Investigations Editor with Global, Lewis Goodall, also a third of the news agents. Hi, Lewis. How are you?
I'm not bad, thank you. How are you?
With deepest sympathies to you and your colleagues. It's been a very hectic couple of weeks. How are you coping with it?
Oh, sympathies, come on. You know, we're all journalists here. Like, I mean, you know,
I was like, I'm jealous.
I don't know what, how is the Martin Varadkar handover going? Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, by comparison, I mean, again, the great thing about Ireland, right, is that at least you can kind of, you're close enough to it that it can all feel really kind of connected and sometimes a little bit too connected, right? But you can kind of live vicariously. You can still sort of say, oh, well, that's happening over there.
Yeah.
So it's, look, I mean, like it's hour by hour, as always with this stuff. And, you know, you never quite know what is going to happen next. I mean, basically, you know, the Conservative Party is very good, has been very good now at inflicting its psychodrama on the rest of politics. And, you know, I think we're just like a bit like the frog in the boiling jar now. We've just got so used to it becoming sort of crazier by hour by hour. But, you know, I don't know what we'd quite do now if things went back to normal, if there is such a thing.
Well, it is exciting. Tell us in a brief synopsis, how has it come to this point, Lewis, for our listeners?
How long you got?
I mean, we've got a 15-minute window. Keep it tight. In summary.
Okay, right. Let's go back to the Maastricht Treaty of 1992.
No.
I don't know. I mean, look, the situation as it is now, while about 3 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, you know, Truss has done Prime Minister's questions. It was a pretty bad performance. It was probably worse, even worse than most people expected, which is kind of, wow. You know, it's kind of difficult to achieve in these circumstances. But it's very difficult for her. What could she say? You know, I mean, like Number 10 have alighted upon this line of, well, I had a courageous decision. You know, it was very difficult for me to turn back on everything I said, I believe, but I realized that was the right thing, and that's what I've done. I mean, and that is really small beer, right? Because basically the argument is like tantamount to, yeah, I went and set the house on fire. I was an arsonist, and I let all of the contents of the house, all the furniture and everything inside it, burn to a crisp. But, you know, after 3 weeks, I did go and get a hose and pull it out. And that did take real courage because I'd put it on fire in the first place. You know, that really, it doesn't cut much mustard. Do you know what I mean? It's a difficult argument to sustain. So it's difficult to know what she can say. And, you know, the truth is that, you know, Conservative MPs we're playing that game again of, you know, how many letters have been sent to Sir Graham Brady, who basically spends his entire life having letters handed to him by his colleagues, calling in no confidence. I mean, I don't know what he would do. He's probably the busiest 1922 committee chairman there's ever been, you know, and we're playing that game all over again. And he's basically said that if he gets to a third, or he's let it be known that if it gets to a third of his colleagues have sent him a letter, then he'll go and see the Prime Minister. So we're just playing that numbers game all over again.
So we're in a situation now where a lot of the stuff that she announced as part of a mini budget 3 weeks ago, or at least the Kwasi Kwarteng announced, but that she kind of co-wrote, all of that's been thrown out and he's been sacked for doing something that she agreed with. Is it a situation where it's effectively lose-lose for her, that either she stays on, but that she's kind of got no authority, that she's got no real manifesto to speak of, that she's a Prime Minister in name only, or that they just decide to turf her out and put in someone who's got a bit more authority? There doesn't seem to be any way at all that she can salvage any kind of kudos or credibility out of this.
Well, look, I think that you've got to try and understand the psychology of what's going through her head and her team's head, right? The truth is that they're not really thinking long-term, right? I mean, you know, there's a suggestion that maybe there's a very, very slender path that she can restore stability and, you know, start to project confidence, whatever that means, and get through to October the 31st when there's the midterm budget review, and then get beyond that, and then get to Christmas, and then get beyond Christmas, that somehow she can sort of salvage the situation. The truth is they're thinking literally hour by hour and day by day. And what is the main thing going through her head? Like, why is she thinking, I have to try and salvage this? Well, fundamentally, it's not really about the ideas at this point, because, you know, it's been made very clear that her entire perspective has been junked. You know, Britain's still got the crosshairs of the market, so its room for manoeuvre is very limited. What Liz Truss is basically playing for now is not to be a pub quiz question, not to be a bit of trivia, an asterisk next to her name, the Prime Minister who lasted for 2 months and set her own premiership on fire, because she's got to live with that for the rest of her life, right? She's not even 50. She would be facing down the prospect of every time she goes into the supermarket being sort of loathed because she's the woman who literally cost everybody more in their mortgages, and, you know, a mixture of loathing and mocking. And, you know, that's a very difficult thing for any politician to swallow. So she's just trying to think, can I get to November? Can I get to December? Can I get to 2023? So the numbers next to my name are at least 2022 to 2023 rather than being 2022. It's as base as that, I think. That's what we're dealing with in terms of the psychology.
What does it do to the national psyche, Lewis, when you have, you know, such a fundamental economic policy decided by a British Prime Minister and her Chancellor, effectively upended and binned, scrapped because of the international markets? The fact that the markets can decide then what the policy of the British government is has to have some damage on how the country sees itself.
I think this is an economic sewage, you know, for Britain. I think we get very wrapped up partly because we've all gone through the sort of Conservative Party psychodrama over the last few years. And, you know, obviously we get very worked up in the personalities, what this means for trust, what, you know, actually let's just divorce and forget about that. What has happened over the last few days and weeks has been a deeply revealing moment for British economic power. And if you take a slightly longer view, going back to the start of the Brexit period and so on, there has no doubt been a very visible real terms decline in both British political power, but also economic power as well. And it has been a moment where fundamentally, like Suez, it was a moment of hubris. You have a government come along and say, actually, it doesn't really, Britain has the ability and the strength and the power to buck the market, go against the market, and the market will keep lending to us. And we saw in real terms, real time, that that wasn't true. She tried to do Reaganomics without having the dollar as in her back pocket as a reserve currency, and it didn't work. And I think over the long term, there's two effects of that. One, whatever, British politics has actually just become a lot narrower in the last few days and weeks. The menu available to any British government, whether that's, you know, Liz Truss or someone from the Conservative Party or who replaces her, or even an incoming Labour government, is going to be that much more restricted. Ireland knows about that. Ireland knows what it's like to have the markets suddenly have in their crosshairs and what a debilitating effect that has on politics. Because basically it means that the menu of options available to a government is so much more limited than what it was before. So politics has become much narrower. And I think that in the short term and medium term, and in the long term, I think there's no doubt it's been a humiliating moment for Britain, akin to 1976 and the IMF crisis, or 1992 and Black Wednesday. And that will have an effect both on the psychology of the country, but also of the political class.
And when you look at that then, Lewis, on a kind of a ground level, when you look at towns and villages and cities up and down the United Kingdom and people who are paying their bills and getting on with their lives, what do you hear from them? How are they feeling about all of this?
Well, look, I mean, we've just had a situation where 10%, you know, we've just had inflation, latest inflation figures out, 10% higher than everybody thought it was going to be. It's still hovering about that. And that's the extraordinary thing. We spent the entire summer, basically, as the Conservative Party had its very long leadership contest, speculating and talking about, well, what is the British government's reaction or response going to be to help the public through what is a profound and significant cost of living crisis? Well, we now know what the reaction is going to be, what the response is going to be. And it's a response that no one would have anticipated. It is a, you know, enormous package of tax cuts, which precipitates a financial crisis of international proportions, which then precipitates not only all of the tax cuts going that were promised to help with cost of living, but also chaos in the mortgage markets, which has added to the inflationary problems. And so the British public end up in the worst of all worlds, where not only has there been a crisis in the mortgage markets and interest rates are going to be higher than they would have been, and mortgage costs are going to be higher than they would have been, but we don't even have the tax cuts to cushion the blow. And the British government, which is suddenly denuded of a lot of the policy options and freedom of maneuver that it might have had to try and help everybody. So, you know, the British government is going to be pretty unique in Europe now in essentially its government not be really being able to assist its citizens that much through the autumn and winter. It will a bit around energy, but not as much as thought, at precisely the time when, and on top of that, it's probably going to have to raise, not cut taxes, and cut public spending, at precisely the time when many other European governments are coming out with a package of support measures for their populations. It is just an unfathomable situation by comparison to even a few weeks ago.
There's one thing which I think has caught people's attention here in particular is comedy, really, about this. Michael Spicer, I'm sure you saw the video where he was sort of imitating a journalist getting texts in from Tory MPs about Liz Truss. We actually have a clip of that here, which we can insert there for our viewers.
And not long before we came on air, an ex cabinet minister said to me, watching Liz Truss lead my party is like watching a sea lion driving a Segway into a bear trap factory. She has the aptitude and charisma of a crisp packet in a high wind, and I want her chased out of Downing Street by wolves. I mean, that's just an example.
So Lewis, in reality,
I feel seen.
I was going to ask you, like, I mean, this has been something which I've noticed even with Theresa May and with Boris Johnson as well, is that when there's a Tory leader in trouble, you have MPs swarming to have their spake, as we'd say over here, about the leader, and just basically doing it in as flowery language as possible secretly. Like, what are they saying to you? What is it about them? Do they think that they're going to get these comments broadcast and there's almost a competitive nature to it, or is it a bit of grandstanding? What is it?
Honestly, it is ridiculous. I mean, it's actually, I think, one of the worst parts of like the kind of Westminster village. It's like I think both sides are basically egging the other on, right? The journalists are saying to the Tory MPs, "So what's going on? And how bad is it?" And they go, "Oh, it's very bad. Oh, go on, tell me a bit more. How bad?" And you know, and there's a kind of like competitive element, and it ends up just becoming absurd. It becomes like it descends into kind of the as far as I'm concerned, I want to see her like literally fired out of a cannon, and then I want to see her entrail be picked to bits by the ravens of the Tower of London. Yeah. Or it becomes, you know, you start to get these absurd historical references. This is worse than Talleyrand, you know, and all this sort of like, it just becomes absolutely absurd. Most of it is completely unknowable to the average viewer, listener or reader or whatever. They just think this is absurd, but it just becomes part of the kind of pantomime of the Westminster discourse.
Sometimes it does feel like we wish they'd put as much thought into their choice of leader as they do into their wordplay. we've been spitballing before in this podcast, Lewis, about whether it's plausible or whether the Tories could really pull off changing leader twice in quick succession without kind of getting any public sign-off or sort of going back and checking with the public that they're still on board. And we've sort of reached a conclusion that it's not really plausible or tenable to do that. But I suppose we're in a situation now where they probably would try to do that they would get rid of Liz Truss and bring in someone else and just not bother to consult the public, because consulting the public is a suicide wish, isn't it?
Well, look, there have been lots of things over the last few years that people never thought could be possible, but ended up being possible. One of which, to be honest, was Liz Truss becoming Prime Minister. I think if you'd said that, you know, only a couple of years ago or 6 months ago, well, maybe not 6 months ago, but 12 months ago, so people would have found that an unlikely prospect, right? So I think in the grand scheme of things, given all of the precedents that have been felled and all of the sort of various things that were never ever, could never ever happen that have happened, I think, you know, the Tory party changing PM again in the middle of a parliament, so having three PMs in a year or three PMs in a parliament, isn't probably the most extreme example of that. And the fact of the matter is, A, there is actually, although I think, you know, the public would probably find it, would be incredulous at it, and there would be growing questions around legitimacy for the government, particularly if it was doing more and more things that weren't in the 2019 general election manifesto, which it would be doing because of the crisis in the markets and cuts in public spending and so on. But nonetheless, there's no constitutional requirement to have a general election as long as they can command the support of the House of Commons. And I think, you know, if the Tory MPs are basically weighing up different size catastrophes, right? They're not weighing up good options. They're just weighing up the least bad. And if the choice is between Liz Truss going into the next general election as their leader, which literally almost no Conservative MPs want, on Liz Truss and her inner Praetorian guard, right? Because the thing you've got to remember about her is that she doesn't have, unlike, say, Boris Johnson, who still has a lot of support on the backbenches of the Tory party, and lots of Tory MPs would love to see him back. She doesn't really have a particular constituency within the Conservative Party. She doesn't have a phalanx of her own, really. It was the sort of the Boris Johnson phalanx that sort of swept in behind her, but it's pretty skin deep in terms of their support for her. So, you know, ultimately, the Conservative Party is just weighing up what is the least worst option. And if that were a choice of just, yeah, okay, you're going to have a lot of members of the public going, this is illegitimate, we want a general election, well, frankly, you just sort of grin and bear it and go, okay, well, but it's not going to happen. And just try hope that you've got 2 years to, you know, to grin and bear it and see what happens.
One group of people who didn't expect ever to see Liz Truss and didn't want to see Liz Truss ever become the Prime Minister is actually the Irish government. There was a lot of briefing around the time of the leadership competition that, well, we don't mind who it is as long as it isn't Liz Truss, because she was seen as a Brexit convert, and there's that old saying about never trust a turncoat because they have too much to prove. What do we think about it? I mean, this is obviously a very Irish-led question, but there was a thought, I think even people like Michel Barnier expressed it, that because of the economic upheaval now in Britain, they wouldn't want to have too much of a confrontation with Europe about the Northern Ireland Protocol, for example. So they thought that there might be a lot more space then for a compromise. Has that entered into any thought process there? Is there any likelihood then of that there would be more of a chance of some sort of bridge building with Europe than there would have been otherwise if there wasn't for this, you know, economic shitstorm, I'm going to say, actually, to be honest, a couple of bleepers there.
Well, you know what's sad about this, which is I don't think it's really entering much of their equation or thinking one way or the other, in the sense that this is kind of what happens, right? And we've been so accustomed to it now for a year. We basically haven't had a government in Britain that's not been enveloped in crisis basically all year, because since the start of the year you had Partygate, seems like a long time ago now, whatever, and that just sort of ran, and then you went straight headfirst into all of this as soon as that ended. And I think the truth is that when you have a government which is just in perpetual crisis, everything else goes out the window. And like I said before, everything basically just becomes about hour by hour, day by day survival, staying alive to the next day. And in terms of whether what they're really thinking about, say, the Northern Ireland Protocol, obviously really important, at the very top of government, there just will be no bandwidth to really discuss it. I think, you know, as long as the PM remains weak, it's certainly, and the economy is in a very poor state, it's unlikely that they're going to decide to say, hey, let's just, you know, let's have a trade war with the EU in those circumstances. But, you know, I don't even really think it's entering their bandwidth and thinking very much one way or the other.
Lewis Goodall, Investigations Editor with Global. Thank you so much for joining us on the Group Chat podcast. It's fair to say if you enjoy the Group Chat, you're definitely going to enjoy the newsagents. So make Absolutely. Sure you check it out where you get your podcasts.
Thanks, Lewis.
My pleasure.
Now, a story that has been, I don't want to say dominating social media, it's probably a bridge too far, but...
A fridge too far.
Excellent. That was
not truly, rehearsed in any way. So amazing brilliant. That it happened.
I love that for you.
Good night, everybody.
So, if you haven't seen this, Leo Varadkar posted a story on Instagram saying that Matt, his partner, had done the food prep for the week, as a lot of people do, of a Sunday. And it really garnered an enormous reaction for a couple of reasons. I would say, first of all, it was difficult to establish what was actually in the Tupperware boxes. Mm. A lot of people were zooming in. There was not a lot of clarity on what was in them. Again, each to their own. No one's passing judgment on what everyone's having for dinner. But the lack of... lids, cling film. The Food Safety Authority has felt the need to come out and clarify to people that lids are essential to prevent cross-contamination. An Instagram story that got to this length, I mean, well, what were your thoughts when you saw it?
Well, that's Fine Gael not getting the agriculture brief after the reshuffle then, because like clearly if the food safety people are all over them, then that's that one gone. There's a bit of me that's actually, like, I know sometimes politicians do this kind of artificially to do the whole, like, oh, look, I'm a real person too.
Yeah. Like, well, they are real. Is there not,
yeah, but, well, of course they are.
Yeah.
But is there not a bit, I don't know why the political correspondent has to go out of his way to clarify that politicians are real people, but we are what we are. Just, was there nothing in Leo Varadkar that would go, this looks a bit miserable? Like, is his life so, like, partitioned out and, like, Tupperwared out that there's no bit of you that goes, this actually looks a little bit joyless?
But see, I feel like food prepping is hashtag relatable content on some level. Like, you know, there's a cohort of people who food prep and who are like, you know, hashtag fit fam, hashtag, you know, food prep. Yeah. And like some people, like, I think it's amazing that they have the organizational skills to do that. So I can understand where you're coming from.
And
when you're,
he's
like,
got previous as well, Thursday night being wing night, and the amazingness of himself and Matt having chicken wings and both wearing white shirts and the bravery that takes.
Do you remember one time you said to me, Richard was on a date one time, he said, she ordered chicken wings. I thought,
many years ago,
and I thought, brave girl.
As a woman, by the way.
Brave woman. Anyway. Yeah. It was very funny.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago, but it was very funny. What did you make of it?
Overblown. I'm actually
really?
Well out of it now.
Yeah. I kind of loved it. I'm going to be totally straight. Yeah, I just
find, and like, far be it from us to defend anybody. Like,
yeah.
Some of the reaction is so ridiculous. And I read the worst tweet that I've ever read in my life this morning.
Yeah.
Is that the one about the sterile culture of self-quantification and self-optimization that meal prep represents an ethos?
Yeah, the one I put in the group chat earlier on, yeah.
With the moralistic neoliberalism.
That I thought was a joke towards. And then you were like, that's not a joke.
Yeah.
I thought that was a joke.
2 points. Go outside and touch grass. second point is...
Not today, though. It's very wet.
Stop judging people on what they eat.
Yeah, fair.
Because people have multiple reasons for doing this, whether they have
dietary requirements,
whether they be a Taoiseach or a Taoiseach, future Taoiseach, and his cardiologist partner.
Yep.
Very busy. Probably the best way of getting a home cooked meal is to bring it with them. And then second of all, there's a lot of people who do this for multiple reasons, whether that's fitness and stuff like that, or eating disorders and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was interested to read somebody's take on it, basically that the whole discussion around, oh, why are people pulling the mickey out of Wadley of Radker's eating was quite triggering for them from an eating disorder point of view, which I didn't really think about. But in fairness, I have to say,
fair argument,
the Lids thing was just the worst thing for me now. I will get on board, which is why it was a follow-up
post, wasn't there?
Yeah, so he then reposted, and in fairness, I say he got into trouble at home while he said he did. He said, "I'm in trouble with Matt for not doing justice to his meal prep photos with my photo. For everyone asking, yes, we do use Lids and we do have vegetables." I will say the second photo was very appetizing.
Yeah.
I would say it was really nice.
The do-over
was
great.
The do-over was lovely, actually. I would absolutely go for that. That's quite good.
All around to Leo's for dinner then.
Well, maybe not. But I mean, I think in fairness, you make a valid point there though, in terms of people's reaction. Like, I suppose the Lids though for me with it, like that's, I think this is why I've become completely fixated on it, because I just was like, I can't believe there's no Lids.
Having shared gaffes before with people and them not put Lids on stuff, which absolutely should have Lids on it.
You're very funny.
Is that our kimchi, for example? No, this is just something different.
I would always cover things, but I would put things in bowls with cling film and he'd be freaked. He'd be like, "What? Like, if you're not in a Tupperware box?" And I'd be like, no.
Or just like, you see the condensation building on it and stuff, and like, that's not nice, you know? But like, it's more to do with smelly stuff, like, you know? You can't be leaving stuff like cheese and stuff like that sitting there, or kimchi is my worst example, which I'll always remember, sitting there lidless and the whole fridge becomes just an enormous smelly mess. So
main takeaway is don't live a lidless life.
Yeah.
So James Corden. Now, I didn't know that people had issues with James Corden. This is news to me. I feel like I just have not been in the loop on this. Just to start, for anyone who hasn't seen it this week, he was banned and then unbanned, like no longer banned from a New York City restaurant.
Mm. Quite a good restaurant as well.
Quite a good restaurant.
Officer in Soho.
Yeah, you've been there.
Twice.
You're quite fancy, Gav.
Because I'm such a
You're
foodie.
Quite fancy, yeah.
I've been there, and I have always, and I've only ever known other people to refer to the service as being very good.
Okay.
So the story that you're about to tell of James Corden being somehow unimpressed with the service does make me wonder whether they sort of almost saw him coming and did not put the boat out for him to put their.
But it wasn't the first time he'd had an issue there, was it? I think it happened on a separate occasion.
Oh.
Richard, like James Corden. I suppose I didn't know you've kind of come across a few more yarns about James Corden that you reflected earlier. I just never knew. I thought that he was always the carpool karaoke guy. I thought he was really funny. I don't know if I was aware that there was like
that people hate
an undertone of rudeness there that, like, you know, the people had sort of been aware of.
Yeah.
People just generally hate him.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
This is news to me.
A lot of public figures, I suppose, as well. But James Corden. So just to read again what Keith McNally, who's the owner of Baltasar, said. He described him as a tiny cretin of a man and the most abusive customer since the restaurant opened 25 years ago. Now, he said that James Corden then obviously rang him up and apologised to him.
Only after public shaming, though.
Sometimes it works.
Yeah.
First complaint was about a hair?
Yeah.
Was there a hair in his food? And then he was like, oh, yeah. But anyway.
The second one was about the egg white omelette or something. The omelette had like either it had yolk in it or it had white in it. They wanted either all of one or the other and there was an issue. And
Yeah. But there's been a couple of instances where the internet has been set aflame in recent years about James Corden. I think there was one particular one where he did one of those Ask Me Anything rounds on Reddit. Which was widely covered by the press at the time, in which basically celebrities go on Reddit, the message board thing, and they just allow anybody to ask them, as it says in the tin, ask them anything.
Okay.
And everybody just started asking him very questions about apparent times when they were in his company or in his presence and he was rude to them.
Wow.
So that was widely covered at the time. So it's mad to sort of see that, because you don't really see that often.
No.
Where you have, you know, this level of, oh, I have this anecdote and this anecdote and all that sort of stuff.
You'd think that if it was an AMA with James Corden, that people would be going like, is there going to be another Gavin and Stacey reunion? Do Smithy and... the Welsh character who that Ruth Jones plays, whose name I can't remember. Do they get together? Or like, he's going to be asking about, you know, how much do you have to plan for carpool karaoke? Do you have the route pulled together? Do you have to work through agents? Do you need to rehearse the back catalogue so you know all the lyrics? You don't expect them to be asking about Nessa, by the way, is the character in Gavin and Stacey. You don't expect them to be like asking, like, you know, why is it that you were such an arsehole on this one particular
I really feel like I've been under rock on this whole thing, because I just thought I've always just kind of sort of like loved the carpool karaoke thing and love that persona, but obviously he has managed to hold that together. This is a bit of an unfortunate turn of events. It's interesting though, you know, when you talk to people like we work in television and you meet a lot of people that would like work here and they've met so many different like famous people of varying degrees of fame, and you know, the camera operators will always tell you great stories of the different, like, you know, some of our camera operators have been like to the Oscars and everything, like they've been all over the world meeting some of the most famous people, and they'll always, the one consistent thing that you'd always hear from people is that like actually the more famous people are, the sounder they are, like that generally it's the kind of maybe middle of the road like celebs or kind of the Z-listers that will tend to be a little
like
ruder.
The Tom Hanks criterion, that Tom Hanks is like the most famous actor in the world, but it's partly because,
I mean, that's a sweeping generalization obviously, but I do like that is often like the feedback that you'll get from people who have met a lot of these celebrities. It's like, you know, sometimes that people are a little bit less inclined to be affected by their fame higher up the food chain.
When we were talking about this off air, you gave us one brilliant example of one of the AMA anecdotes where people were like, there was a
people who are going to have to look this up, I think, themselves. I don't want to say something without the right of reply here for James Corden.
Okay,
we'd like to invite James Corden if he wants to come on the group chat to clarify any of these things. But I'm sure he's a perfectly nice guy. But the one thing, so apparently he apologized to Keith McNally, the owner. I don't know if he apologized to any staff involved, and he certainly didn't apologize for cats. So I mean, I think I'm still not in on James Corden anyway.
Which is why you are now going to make your life's business to defeat him in the fantasy football league that you are improbably, but somehow
in the league.
You are in a league with James Corden.
With JC Milan is his team, his name. And Trevor Noah's in it as well.
Now, sorry, hang on a second. There's going to be other people listening to the podcast just like me who don't understand. How are you in this league with him? How does this work?
I know a fella who knows him.
But I don't understand how this happens. Explain to us how this happens.
6 degrees of separation.
I got an invitation. There's a few other people like Micah Richards is in it and Rio Ferdinand from football. I'm actually breaking
circle,
the omerta. So. I'm going to get kicked out of this league, but I'm on top of the league at the moment. So at least I retire undefeated.
Maybe they will kick you out because you're
probably will,
get rid of you. Yeah.
But he's not good at that either.
How many like?
So
JC Milan found rock.
And how many of you are in it?
I think about 30 or 40.
Oh my god, you were proper like 30 or 40 inner circle with James Corden.
Well, you can't message each other in it. I can't ask him. Like, you can't slide into.
I was going to say, could you invite him onto the group chat then?
So when he logs on this weekend,
Balthazar FC. Yeah.
You're actually quite good at this fantasy football stuff. Did you win the thing here last year?
Yeah. So, well, I think I'm second now in the Virgin at the moment.
You're not. Who's winning? Who's in front of you?
I'm not sure. Somebody else is up there. I'll call them out though, because in the hope the podcast can intimidate people into losing fantasy football.
Yeah, no, Richard is currently fourth, but it's very tight at the top.
Oh, so I've dropped down.
All to play for.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us. That's all we have time for this week. Richard Chambers, news correspondent and future football manager.
Well, thanks, Zara.
Stephen Kenny, sign him up.
Yeah. I was going to say. Political correspondent Gavin Riley.
Thank you, Zara.
A long-held mathlete. That's going to be your title, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I think the Matthew thing, we're never going to live it down. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe. We would love you to leave some feedback on the podcast. I suppose it's mainly Apple, isn't it, where you can leave kind of a comment.
Reviews and stuff.
Reviews and stuff. Yeah, we haven't asked you to do that for a little while. But if you're listening now and like you just have your phone in your hand, do write a review and let us know what you think of the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Also, big thanks to Gareth, Killian and Maxine who work on the podcast.
Here.
And we will see you on the group chat again next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.